Go. This is Thursday, February 14th, 2008. We have nine items to go over on our study session. The first one is a review of items that we will consider on the February 19th regular council meeting. Let's go ahead and turn to that in our packets. Anything on page one or two? Vice Mayor.
I have a question on 4A, which is a liquor license for the AMPM. My question is that there are a lot of calls for service here, and in fact, on average, you're getting almost one every 2 days. Is that typical for this kind of a user?
Vice Mayor Walters, it's not unusual for this type of market. It's higher than the cases that you've seen, the liquor license applications that you've seen in the last year, I would say.
Yeah, it's quite a bit higher. Maybe somebody from PD can have a conversation with me about this after. Is there somebody here from PD today? Well, I'll get with them.
Yep.
Thank you.
The recommendation for the 4B, is that going to be only if they get their permits, similar to what we did before, or what's?
The Cheap Seats received their permits yesterday, so we can go ahead and put them on consent.
Okay.
Sam Bella's, we're still working with the applicant. They're having some, they have not resubmitted their changes to the building safety division, so we don't anticipate that they'll be able to get their permits by Tuesday.
Do we need to make any notation that, like we did on the last case, I believe we sent it forward, but only with a verbal that
yes.
All permits are?
Mayor, if the council is going to recommend denial, we have to specifically identify the basis for that denial. And failure to obtain permits is an identified valid purpose.
Okay, so it'll only stay on consent then if everything's been pulled and it's properly done.
It's not on consent now.
It's not now, but I thought you said that they were pulling permits and it would be okay to put it on consent.
I'm sorry. There's two off consent today.
Okay, so 4B can go back on or not?
Is that Cheap Seats on?
Yes. Yeah.
Cheap Seats.
Right.
has pulled their permits and they can go on consent.
Okay.
Sam Bella's does not have their permits yet. They
all
still
right.
have to resubmit their changes to the building safety division.
Okay, understand. All right, that's page three, or page two, page three. Vice Mayor.
Question on 5B, which is the 3-year supply contract for residential refuse and recycling containers for solid waste. My question is this. With a slowdown in construction, is this contract to just get them as we need them? I'm looking back there, Willie. Is this just to get them as we need them? Or do you buy a set amount? Do you factor in the fact that things have slowed down in terms of residential construction?
Mayor and Vice Mayor and Council, what we do is we keep a just-in-time inventory. We only buy what we need.
Okay, that's what I needed. Thank you.
All right. That's page three, page four. Mike, Mike's not here this morning. We have 6B and 6E pulled because of Wayland conflicts, right? The 6H, I appreciate the work that we've done on water, use it wisely, and if we can save some administrative costs, let's give that a trial shot. So I certainly am glad somebody's following up on that. Anything else on page 4? Page 5? This would be take action on ordinances introduced at prior council meetings. All right, page 6. And that's it. Any questions on the agenda? All right, let's go back to item number 2 then. Just hear a presentation, discuss and provide feedback on the 2008 Major General Plan Amendment application.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. This morning we are going to talk about the two applications and the overall process for the Major General Plan Amendment for 2004. We're going to talk about the application process and the schedule, the new land use category that's going to impact these proposals, and discuss at, and get feedback from the council for the applicant. This is 2008 schedule for all major general plan amendment. The first submittal was January the 14th, and like today is the council first initial input, February the 14th, and then we are scheduled for P&Z input on February 21st, and then the applicant is supposed to take all this input and revise the application and resubmit it on March 28th. Then by the state law, we are supposed to give 60-day review period, which will run from April 25th through June 25th. And then at the end, like in July, P&Z will have the first meeting, second meeting will be in August, and the earliest council can have their action on September 15th. So that's why I put it tentative, which will all depend on how the outcome in the P&Z and the councils. Recently, council has adopted this new land use category. We call it mixed use community. The expectations are to encourage broad ranges of mix of uses to ultimately create a complete community. It requires nodes and cores to create a sense of identity and also allow flexibility in design, flexibility in land use location, specific land uses and their intensity, and be sensitive to environmental constraint. Council also has recently adopted PC district, we call, Planned Community Zoning District, basically to implement this land use category. And this land use category is only applicable to large tract of land, minimum 160 acres. We received two applications for this year. One is the DMB case number Major 0801. The applicant is Grady Gamage. The property owners is DMB, State Trust Land Flood Control District. Approximately it's 3,600 acres. Levine is the other case, GP Major 0802. The applicant is Paul Gilbert, property owner Andrew Cohen, and it's around 1,700 acres. Both these applications are located near the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport. DMB case number GP Major 0801 is between Hawes and Signal Butte and south of Elliott. And Levine is north of Pecos Road between Ellsworth and Signal Butte.
Let me stop for just a second. Yep. Levine came through last year.
Right.
And we cited the potential freeway corridor and some other issues.
Right.
I haven't followed Levine as close as I have DMV. What is Levine doing? Is it mostly arterial streets and such, or what?
At this application request, they're not showing any of those. They're just applying for getting the land use category established, the mixed use category for the entire.
So they want to go for the overall mixed use and then do some other type of financing. So we're not really talking about then the freeway separation and the departure corridors on this parcel, or could we be engaged in that type of discussion now?
Mayor, that's a good question. We will think about that as we go through here. As we go through with this participation, we'll focus our presentation. We'll be focusing a little bit more on the DMB piece and then the Levine piece and raise some of the issues about, you know, what it is they're applying for now and get some feedback. And so that's a type of question we may want to bring up to them that we'll want to look at more closely in their application.
Okay, because I thought the Levine, we set land uses through it and changed all that. So I'd be curious to see if they're just looking for the overall to do it in increments or how much flexibility that gives them to modify what we've already determined for land use categories.
Right, Mayor, and that will be part of the topic we'll discuss in a little bit, but essentially that is what they're after. They want to develop pretty much the same thing that they got approved before, but this new category gives them some more flexibility in how to kind of adjust those lines a little bit, not quite such a rigid line on a map, but certainly we'll have to respect some of those key elements that we established in the previous amendment.
Okay. The other, isn't the state trust land part of this too? I see you have DMB, but isn't it?
Right.
But they're not
right there.
It's noted as DMB because they've signed off to let DMB do the planning. Is that why we call it just DMB?
No, in fact, the application, I just called it DMB, but basically there is three pieces of ownership.
Okay. All right, next one does show that. Okay, and how does somebody, is it because of the There's a legal document allowing DMB to do the planning for the state trust land that has happened in other areas, but it got, because I thought that was one of the major drawbacks of not being able to plan state trust land, is you couldn't do it until you had a buyer. So how does that work, that DMB can do the planning for state trust land? Is that
state trust land gave DMB, we have in the application, the authority to plan along with their whole application.
All right, so it must be that DMB is picking up all the money or the cost of that then, because otherwise I thought that was part of the state trust land reform, where they wanted to allow state trust land to do master planning, but they didn't have any money for it. So how does that work? Did DMB, is DMB footing the bill for this?
Yes, they're saying yes.
You can ask DMB that question.
DMB saying yes.
Okay.
That's our understanding.
And so then it still goes out to an open auction, and you may or may not get it with whatever's planned?
Correct. Mayor, members of the council, Grady Gamage for DMB, and you're exactly correct. We're paying to plan the state trust land. It's up to the state land department then to decide how to parcelize it and auction it pursuant to the plan. We don't get reimbursed for the planning. We don't get any leg up in the auction. It's a great deal. But it gets their land planned. So.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
So as we were discussing, like, DMB's application covers this entire area, but then there is three jurisdictions, the state trust land, DMB, and the flood control district have a narrow channel there. This is what it is today in that DMB area, the current land uses. We have mixed-use employment, mixed-use residential. We have medium-density residential. We have community commercial office. And state trust land area, we have regional commercial and offices and business park. This is what they are proposing. They are taking this entire area and asking for mixed-use community. That's why I think mixed-use community's definition is kind of important, that it allows that flexibility for them to play with that specific land use locations, flexibility in design, and also phases. This is their land use allocations in terms of what's current in the general plan today and what's proposed. Like, currently in the general plan, that we have MDR for 1,400 acres, almost 44% of the entire area. And this is a distribution of, like, how it's showing. Like, we have mixed-use residential, 230 acres, mixed-use employment, 1,200 acres, 1,300 acres almost. We have business park, 162, office for 26 acres, and community commercial for 42 acres. So this is the current distribution, but they're basically saying is we're taking all this mix and we're applying for mixed-use community, so that gives us the flexibility not to exactly say how much percentage and all that. And it obviously will more clarified when they come for PCD, district zoning district, because at this time they're asking for just land use category. This is what the state trust land portion is, which is much smaller. It's only 435 acres. And our current general plan has all these regional commercial, business park, office, and community commercial. They're again taking that entire area and asking for mixed-use community on that area.
Let me. I heard that this is what we were going to get today, but we saw some other diagrams where we saw a golf course and potential resort hotel and higher density and the rest. And I kind of like that. Going that way, now it seems like we're going backwards to say we just want all mixed-use community, trust us, we'll come up with something later. And I guess the later is the next council will get more details when it goes through P&Z, or when are we going to get...
Mayor...
I think this is... Well, go ahead.
Mayor, Council, again, as we go forward a little bit with the presentation, we'll get into some of that, and I think that's one of the pieces of feedback we're looking for from the Council to give back to the applicant. They've given us their written project narrative, which describes all those things in words. I think it would be beneficial to get a few maps and illustrations to go with those words to help send us that direction. As this does come on through the process, though, for the DNB piece, they will be following up with their planned community district zoning designation. They're planning to apply for that in March. By the time it gets to council, you'll be seeing both applications. So you will see the detail through the zoning request that you're not seeing in the general plan designation. But anyway, we do need to, I think, make sure the policy is being set clearly through the mixed-use community designation itself. with the words and with supplemental maps that might should go with
so
that.
So if I come back on July 31st, I can go to the first P&Z meeting and give my input? I thought this was supposed to come through a little bit more with some detail, and I know that originally we did with this council. Now we're going back to a mixed-use community for the whole thing. That I have some question about not having that laid out a little better, personally. So, all right, Tom?
I was just going to say my understanding is that this is just a major amendment to the general plan. That's just changing the underlying zoning. So they still have to come back with their plan community designations that does all the details, but they can't do that until the underlying general plan is amended. So I understand that this is just step one to that process. All those details come with the plan community maps, the plan community stuff. So I guess I'm not as concerned about it because I didn't expect it at this level. This is just changing the zoning.
And if that is the case, then when do we get to see the refined maps to know what's going to go in different areas with some type of assurance that, and I'm still concerned about flight patterns and pushing up against Elliott Road with residential. So when do we, and I thought we had some preliminary ones done, which were being modified. Now we seem to be going back to mixed-use commercial or community on everything.
Yeah, Mayor, the project narrative that is attached with this kind of very generic map starts to lay out where those land uses are going to be. Some of the feedback we need from council is how much you need in there so that you'll feel comfortable if you approve this pretty generic map that you've got some guidance behind that as to where the land uses can or cannot occur. And so, again, I think it's part of the feedback to provide to the applicants today, letting them know what you're going to need for some comfort level to move forward with this.
Mayor John, maybe what you should do, why don't you, this mixed-use community is kind of new for the city. Because that, let's talk a little bit more about that process, too. Because I think that gives an opportunity that's unique that we don't currently have an existing zoning today. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Maybe that'll help assure the council about their, how involved, or what they'll be able to see during that zoning process.
Vice Mayor.
I think that there's another critical element that's missing here, though, and that is that a major general plan amendment takes a year. We won't be voting on approving this until, what's the date?
September 15th,
September.
At the earliest.
Uh-huh. In the meantime, the zoning is going to come along. So that zoning map can then run simultaneously with this amendment. So if those things aren't on that zoning map that you need to have on the zoning map, you can vote no on the general plan amendment. We aren't voting today on the general plan amendment. We're giving input. Am I misrepresenting something here?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, that is correct in terms of this northern piece. In terms of the Levine piece at this point, they're also applying for the mixed-use community general plan change. They are not at this point prepared to come forward with their PCD zoning. So in that case, you will just see the general plan change without the accompanying zoning that gives you that little bit
then
more detail.
Then we're going to have more conversation with them and more specificity.
Councilmember Jones.
As one who will be here in September, I don't really have a lot of heartburn over the process right now because we are just doing the underlying land use, something we've been developing now for quite some time. And we've seen preliminary maps that you've mentioned, and they're going to be more refined as we go through the process. But just putting the underlying mixed-use designation on this is the first step in the whole process, and I have no heartburn whatsoever, and I'm ready to move forward with it.
Well, and we could have done this a year ago, and it would have been fine with me too if the details were coming forward right afterwards. But now it seems to happen, and I've taken a huge interest in the Gateway area. It seems like we now have mixed-use community, and that gets us through this council, and then the other council gets to see the details, and we have five new members. Our potential. It's so that's what I was hoping to refine a little bit more, some of the preliminary maps that I thought were absolutely on track. But now it's like, okay, this is all you guys get to see, and the new council gets to see it all.
Sure.
And that's why I thought we wanted to start this process early enough that this council could have the input and say if the direction was going right or not. And now it seems like we're going back a step. So Those are my only comments.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor. Well, again, I think it'll be helpful as we go through the rest of the presentation this morning and we get into a little bit more of the details of each one, and then the council can provide staff and applicant with a little bit more detail about what you are going to need to see or what you think the future council will need to see to be comfortable in approving these cases.
Okay. Pat?
Perhaps on that March 28th final submittal, we could have a little more detail. I'm assuming a little more refined from what we saw before, possibly. Look at Jill back there and Grady. That maybe you'd feel more comfortable with it at that point for that final submittal on March 28th.
Okay. Well, the existing current general plan land use map has mixed-use employment on about a half a mile or swath right up next to Ellsworth on both sides. And I'm trying to figure out why we are going to be changing that dramatically and what's going to fit in there that will not jeopardize the departure pattern for Williams Gateway. And that's the crux of my concerns.
Yes, Mayor, and we knew that would be an important issue, and we've been talking about it. I think you need to feel comfortable, the council needs to feel comfortable that the plan that's coming forward is going to respect some of those issues and concerns we've had.
Okay. Okay, Mayor, if I can focus on two tables here I have that got from the applicant's project narrative. One is the employment generation numbers. The darker color, of course, is their proposed one, and they're comparing with our general plan. So basically, we see three numbers, 30,000, roughly 54,000, and 68,000 jobs. So their proposal claims that it will generate 68,000 jobs. The housing density-wise, the proposal claims it's almost like 15,000 dwelling units. At this point, we don't know what type of residential is it, but it's just 15,000 potential for 15,000 dwelling units and 68,000 jobs. The applicant's planning concept, this might help a little bit, is that they mentioned these things is like to create a place that attracts significant high wages, create a place that strongly connectivity with the airport and the ASU, create a place that has a diverse and distinctive open space system, and a walkable neighborhood, create a place with a multimodal transportation, embrace sustainability, foster culture, incorporate broad spectrum of living opportunities. Some of these, maybe in the exhibit, will be much better explained. Their proposed development includes the following elements. So multiple centers, convention and resort, hospitality, urban open space, executive housing, urban village, and connected transportation system. This is what staff has felt like council. We need council input for the applicant on the following items. The application boundary, because we have talked about whether the boundary should really go back. I can go back to that image, especially include the state trust land across the freeway. That was an issue discussed. Then the job creations, the numbers, and also the single residence homes. For the environmental reasons and some of the flight path reasons, we like to be more comfortable where they are going, what type of residential. And then higher density. Is it dense enough? Are we comfortable what they proposed already for a urban area in this area? Phasing of development. We have time and time seen like these type of development can start from the other end, means you only see the residential portion and the commercial comes back so late. But this is our opportunity to ask the applicant. For example, DMB itself has done in Verado that they built the commercial. They didn't wait for the rooftops to support that. That's just one example I see in this valley. So this is our opportunity to ask them, can they commit what phasing they will do? Are we going to see the residential portion of this whole development first and wait for the commercial? I don't know how long. So. This is our opportunity to ask. And any other that council thinks, because these are the ones we staff thought about and we put here. I can pause here and then start lobbying. That might be better rather than doing the whole presentation together.
Okay, I'll run through some feedback. The application boundary I think is fine, and I really do like the concept of bringing in the state trust land. To get that done in conjunction, it makes a lot of sense.
Mayor, just a little focus that discussion just a little bit more. Staff's question has been going across the 202 to the west. that piece is not connected with the rest of it. The 202 forms some boundary in this community that's getting created, and it might be more appropriately organized with the rest of the property on the west of the freeway. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of our one question. Should that piece be included within this? And again, it could be fine.
I would say if somebody wants to help the state trust land and do some planning, it's still open for a bid process, and somebody, I assume that the state trust land can reject it and bid it with the different criteria than to accept this. So I would say it's better than not doing any. But that's just my idea. The job creation, I think I've been impressed with the numbers and the type of jobs that I've heard in the narrative. So I think the numbers, 68,000, we obviously talked about 100,000 jobs in that area. That's a chunk of those right there. So that's good. The single residential homes is a concern of mine, depending on where they're located. You know, we have an existing master plan that doesn't allow them in there. I have heard some talk about a different style, where it's a high rise, where it's not an outdoor type of activity. It's a mostly confined within the corridors of the high rise, or however. I'm still open to some further discussion on that. But we also talk about having a walkable community, and sometimes having airplanes fly on over the top and having that kind of noise, at least it's distracting to me over in Tempe when those jets come in. So I think there's a little rub between the two activities. But if you're going to have a backyard and an outside area, I think that that should be away from the flight patterns. If it's enclosed within an apartment or a high-rise condo type of thing, I have some flexibility on where those are located, if this council even makes that approval process. Higher density, I would encourage it. There are certain areas in there where the noise contours will not conflict at all, and I would like to, as much as possible, focus that residential and the higher density in those areas. I think you need that synergy to make it happen. The phasing, there was some talk about a resort or a golf course, also a trail system. It would be nice to kind of know the layout of that so that it connects and you don't do one part that doesn't match up with something else, so that the whole community does have that sense of feel and kind of establishes its own, you know, kind of the Los Cendas area. They have the trail system. This will be obviously different, but something that ties that whole community together, so it's thought out and planned out, and I think the original plan submittals do that. And then the other one that I'm real concerned about is the major arterials. When we do the transportation network, and we do this thing in phases, if we do, we're working with Queen Creek and Pinal County and ADOT and Prop 400 money, so that coordination with DMB and Levine and the State Trust Land and Queen Creek and Apache Junction and Florence and everybody else, I think, is going to be critical so that we can alleviate a little bit of that roadblock that's currently there for some poor planning in Pinal County. And otherwise, I appreciate having Levine also taking a look at this area, because I think that the two are really synergistic. I actually think that the Levine has the property out along the freeway corridor that might warrant some of the higher density residential in the urban core more than the DMB piece, which doesn't have quite as much freeway frontage. So that's always been kind of unique, to try to see how DMB is going to access the freeway when General Motors made a huge mistake in not allowing us to go through their property earlier. And Levine got the choice piece because the freeway does bisect it. So I think Levine and their plan has the really the best opportunity for one huge urban center right off with great access. So I'd be anxious to see if Levine would do some preliminary work to see how it complements the DMB piece or competes against it, one or the other, because I think that if both parcels were submitted by one developer, I think the plan would be substantially different than what we're seeing today, because I think they would move more of it down towards the Levine and the freeway access than what they're doing up by, I think they're pushing too much by Elliott Road, which to me conflicts a little bit with our departure corridor. And the key is to make sure that there is no negative impacts on Gateway. I'd go back to the existing general plan if I had to, just to protect Gateway. So that's what I'm working from, is that employment center underneath. And if it can accommodate some type of other development, then I'll look at it. But otherwise, I'm pretty comfortable with our existing master plan. So that's the standard that they have to set for me. Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. I agree with the mayor on the application boundaries. The state trust land, to have it planned, is so meaningful, and to have somebody who's willing to put down their own money to do it with no advantage to them, other than you get some consistency in planning, I think we ought to go ahead with that. In terms of job creation, and I expressed this to Jill from DMB yesterday, I think that the key there is going to be making sure that the floor area ratios are in the zoning that comes forward, that they're minimum, so that you can't come back later on to a future council and say, well, you know we intended a five-story there, but we have the right to a one-story. We can't have that as an existing right if we're going to get the job creation that we need to have. So in that area, when that comes forward for the zoning piece of it, we need to make sure that those floor area ratios, minimums, maximums are in there. In terms of single residential, there are already 1,400 acres in the existing general plan. So I don't have a problem with our looking at, we even talked about it when we did that, you know, we were drawing lines on a map and we were trying to decide what the right place was. Because it's sideways to the airport at certain places here, there, you really aren't in the flight paths, which is why we have currently 1,400 acres of medium density residential in the existing general plan as it is today. Higher density, I would say absolutely. And once again, that goes to, you know, what's compatible with surrounding uses. And if you're going to have some noise from an airplane, you want to have it be a higher density. That's not where single family residential should be at all. I absolutely concur that maintaining the viability of the airport has to be number one on our list. We can't say, well, yeah, but we're getting a great project, but we lose the airport. And in my conversations with both DMB and Levine, they agree. I don't think they're looking for that. The problem isn't, in my mind, our current users or the current desire. It's making sure that we protect it for future users, for sale, anything like that that happens. I think we're fairly fortunate that we only have three applicants, because you're right, Mayor, if it were all one, you know, that would even be maybe the best of all worlds. But with Paragon and DMB and Levine having so much of the acreage out there, and then DMB having access to planning on the state trust land, I think it is a real advantage in terms of what we get. And then on phasing of developments, of course, we're looking at a project here that's going to be decades in getting done. And so my concern is that we have standards in place, and that the narratives and what gets passed have standards in place that hold people to a high minimum standard, so as we go forward phasing over time, that we end up with something that's really good. And then my other thing is the connections to ASU and Gateway. The narrative was good in talking about the transportation connections, but we need to make sure that those roads are in place that the mayor talked about, that other opportunities for connections are in place, because that's going to be one of the most, I think potentially the most challenging thing that we're dealing with here in terms of the way everything that got handed to us is set up, you know, with your runway angled, with how do you get around and how do you get to ASU on this side and the terminal on that side. I think that's going to be the really big challenge. Thank you.
Okay. Any other feedback? Darrell.
I think I'm just going to state the obvious to make sure I understand it. As I look at this chart, it just seems like the residential is basically the same number of acres and the same number of units and certainly the same density. Do I conclude the right thing, that it's basically the same density as what's already permitted?
We're driving for a lot higher density.
No.
Well, okay, I see in the chart, I see that there were 1,630 acres. And between the two categories, 15,375 units, now I see 1,600 acres and 15,060 units. It looks a lot alike to me. So I don't see the higher density part of this.
No, when we were talking about higher density, or I kind of mentioned, we were specifically saying about the commercial part because the FARs as...
I understand that. And so what I'm wanting to see is if the council is thinking higher density also means higher residential density or not, or if that's even important to you.
Mayor, Councilmember Truitt, if I may, on the chart there on the bottom of this page 11, we've got the 1,600 acres that's in a density range of 4 to 6 dwelling units per acre. So what that chart does is, if they built at 4 dwelling units per acre, it would be 6,000.
Oh,
if they
built
at 6, it would be 9.
Oh, I was
so
adding those two.
Range.
I was
so
adding those
together.
Two together.
So
I'm
the
sorry.
Maximum currently would be 9,000. They're proposing 15,000.
Okay.
So there's 6,000 more units in the same acreage, so it will be a higher density.
Okay. I thought that I was supposed to add those two numbers together. Never mind.
Mayor? Can I also suggest to the council, one of the things that we're going to need to bring to council real quickly, too, because I think that will help the council establish its preference based on the HDR study about where kind of arterials and discussion about, land uses that may be more appropriate. We're going to be ready to bring that to council here, back to council in the next couple of weeks. And that was really kind of intended to be, for the council to kind of use that as their base to then refer the development community to and say, this is what we see as our kind of broad goals and where the transportation nodes are, where maybe broadly different types of land uses might be. And so we can bring that to the council here fairly quickly so that we can also use that as a reference point and use that maybe to give direction in the narratives or refer to as we look at these general plan amendments also.
Okay. Other comments on it? So what's, if we go back to the second page here, the schedule of events.
Yes, Mayor, we still have the Levine piece of the review to go through.
All right.
So
okay.
Why he'll hit that.
Yeah. This is the Levine piece, which is around 1,700 acres, way on the south side, basically south of the DMB property. And then they have, this is what council has approved 2006, we have regional commercial, MDR, business park, mixed-use employment, light industrial, community commercial in this piece. This is what they're proposing, the same thing. They just took the whole piece and said, let's ask for mixed-use community.
On the bottom of the Levine property down there, is there a particular reason why that corner is cut out?
Lower right-hand corner.
Okay, this
right
piece?
Because it's raw land sitting there. I'm just curious why it wasn't in their planning.
I cannot answer exactly, but this is how, in 2006, they applied for this piece. But also, since you raised the question, I'll say this is not the way they were approved in 2006. This piece in the last negotiation with the council, if you remember, that these pieces were taken out so that there is no residential. But in this application, they included that.
Susan Dimmitt with Buse Gilbert. And that the piece down in the lower right-hand corner that you're referring to is not a piece that we control or own.
Oh, really? Right.
Is it currently vacant land? What's all?
As far as I know, it is.
Yeah, it's
I don't know who owns that.
Okay.
Who owns the part of the proving ground that is on the other side of Signal Butte?
Oh, that little notch there?
Well,
this is the piece of...
I don't know if they ever used it, but they owned it.
No. There's a little piece right there on slide 15. There's a little black outline.
You're talking about this piece? Is this the piece?
Is it this one?
No. This right up there, yeah.
Andrew Cohen for the Levine entity. It was a 105-acre non-contiguous parcel that was owned by General Motors that we bought when we purchased the original 1,799 acres. Our general plan amendment was only the subject of 1,699 acres. We did not plan that one. That, I think, is currently in general plan for 4 to 6 dwelling units to the acre, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Yeah, that's... Why would it not be included?
I'll need to
It is. Okay.
So that this application basically includes the entire area for the mixed-use community. And their land use allocations are also like that. They basically took the previously approved general plan and said, like, we want 1699 acres, 100% mixed-use community. Their employment generation claims 29,000 jobs for that area and residential anywhere between 2,000 to 3,000 dwelling units. And their project vision is also not similar, but I would say, like, they claim that development includes employment core and suburban core, which we saw last time more exhibits in 2006. Unfortunately, this time they haven't submitted those, the urban core and the suburban core, but their project narrative mentions about those. And we want the feedback from the council on the similar topics like application boundary, job creation, especially in this case, south of the freeway, the residential units that we talked about in 2006 and the higher density and the phasing of development. That's That was a lot.
You know?
Councilmember Jones.
This one is a little more concerning because of the south side of the freeway and making sure that corridor is open. The only guarantee we have is when they bring back their actual the planning layout that we would be able to say no housing south of the freeway. How, in a legal sense, how much can we control that? I mean, we do have control, but down the road, are we going to get ourselves in a bind? Are we going to be able to really make sure we keep the residential north of that freeway?
Mayor and Council, while Donna's coming up, that is a little bit of staff's concern with this and why we wanted to particularly highlight this with this particular application. We think it may be appropriate to delete the mixed-use community request from south of the freeway, just focus it north of the freeway, because the idea of the mixed-use community is that kind of it does allow those uses to kind of spread out and mix, so you're creating that community. But we know we don't want any residential south of the freeway. We don't want any south of Williamsville Road. So why give the impression that it might be appropriate through approval of this land use designation south of the freeway?
And that is definitely my concern there. On slide 18, where we already have the mixed-use employment and the business park south of the freeway, I'm really not anxious to open that up to anything but that.
This, appreciate the comment. The conversation when we were talking about the flexibility of doing projects at different times, tweaking them a little bit on ranges of housing or employment, but overall coming in with the same type of a build-out master plan and taking advantage of market conditions, that sounded really good. But now we're going from a land use master plan that we have pretty much established to one that is now colors blue on here, all blue, a mixed-use community. The narrative is going to tell us some of what's going to happen, but I have the same kind of concerns that Kyle does, that with the other hard kind of colors on a map, we know that there's no residential there. I'm not sure that there couldn't be residential in the blue and they now say, well, you approved this master plan change. So I don't mind giving the flexibility, but I don't want to give it away to a point that it might jeopardize what we think is good land use planning. And that's my rub. So can somebody tell me that the whole blue area to go to mixed use community is just fine? We still get what we want? Or does it open up so much of the ability to change that I should be concerned?
Mayor Donna Bronski from the Legal Department. This is some of the growing pains that we have with this new process, because the general plan mixed-use community pretty much leaves it all open to later planning. You start to get more specificity especially when you go to the, if you go to the PC district, you'll get the specificity or a little bit more specificity in the community plan. And if they zone to one of the other districts when they come through on this parcel, then you would have even more specificity because that's the more traditional zoning that you're used to seeing where it designates what kind of use is going to go in what region on the parcel. So there, the trade-off of getting the flexibility to respond to market conditions that we're all embracing as part of this new general plan designation and new PC district, part of that retaining of the flexibility means that you need to pay special attention when you're adopting the standards at the zoning level and then trust the developers to stick with, and with the staff's direction and review, to stick with those goals that you're going to set, goals and standards, as they develop over time and then respond to their market conditions. So yes, my answer is yes and no. Your control is in setting the standards. The flexibility is to the property owners to develop within those standards that you're going to set as part of the community plan.
Are there any financial to finance this, the infrastructure that would be tied into having a mixed-use community designation? So is it separate and distinct that if we start doing some type of community facilities district or something else for financing, that any area could qualify, or is it going to be a mixed-use community? Is there a financial incentive to have the mixed-use community designation? Not yet, but is that where we're leading to? Is there something just below the surface I'm not seeing?
Mayor, members of the council, there's nothing in either the general plan or in the zoning district that has a financial aspect. Where you might be thinking about it is there is a requirement in the PC district that there be a development plan that comes along, a development agreement that comes along with the community plan. And we're anticipating on the DMB parcel that there will be financial aspects. I'm not as familiar with the Levine parcel. I don't believe that they're at that level of design to really be able to tell us that.
And Mayor, there's beyond that. There's an element of the type of development that we want to encourage that sustains itself for a different type of infrastructure. Meaning that we saw this in one of the HDR presentations under those three different scenarios, based on the plan or the type of development that would occur and the necessary infrastructure to support it. There really is a difference between infrastructure and the type of development support and the cost to the city. And we can review that again because that does speak to densities, the mix of uses, because, you know, are you building a tremendous amount of infrastructure to move jobs in here and then move jobs out, or move people come into the area and out of the area, but you don't retain the tax base to really pay for that infrastructure over time. So we can look at that. The CFDs that are being discussed really are related in some broad categories of development. Those are still very premature, those discussions about the CFDs and the type of infrastructure and the scope that they would cover in this area. But yes, we've been having some most preliminary discussions, but I'm not sure we've related it specifically to these general plan amendments.
So there's not a movement to go back to mixed-use community because it matches better with the CFD financing?
We haven't had that discussion at all.
Okay. Tom?
I guess I'm going to try to pose a concrete legal question if I can. Prefaced with a comment that I care very little about all of this, but right now below the freeway there are zoning for mixed-use employment, business park, commercial centers. There's no legal entitlement to have houses below the freeway. If we adopt the mixed-use community for the entire parcel, which includes the part south of the freeway, can the developer claim a legal entitlement to put residential below the freeway because he now has mixed-use community, and mixed-use community includes residential on the entire parcel?
You said that's what I was asking.
Mayor, Councilman Rawls, nothing in a general plan process creates entitlements. The general plan process sets up the plan. The entitlement section is when you follow with the zoning, and the zoning must be consistent with the general plan. The general plan sets the universe of possibilities that it can be zoned to, but the council still has the ability to make a decision, yay or nay, on which of those particular zoning categories are appropriate when they come back with a rezoning application.
Okay, so the answer is we can legally deny an application or a development or a zoning request to put residential south of the freeway, even if we make this mixed-use community in the general plan.
That's correct.
That's the.
On what basis? Yeah,
Is there? He has a question. On what basis
on
do
what
we have?
Basis?
Do we have? Are there? Are we limited in our abilities to do that, or is there? Do we have to find an articulable reason, or can we just say we don't want it below the freeway because we want to protect whatever we're trying to protect?
Councilman Rawls, all zoning and members of the council, all zoning decisions are legislative acts, and there is no right to any particular zoning district. So as long as it's a reasonable decision and you meet the reasonable person test, you have full discretion.
Okay, so that's I think hopefully Kyle that answers the question. So there's really no legal danger in adopting the mixed-use community for the entire parcel from a ability to control what's put in below the freeway.
Councilman Rawls, that's correct. Within the universe of, you're limited to those districts that are allowed under the general.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
A couple of questions. Is there anything currently in Mesa law or Arizona law that would prevent a community facilities district from being organized in Mesa?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, no.
Okay. Well,
there are council policies about the different kinds of CFDs, but that's within your ability to change.
Okay, because I keep hearing one person saying that Mesa doesn't allow CFDs, and I've never known that to be true, but just wanted to double check on that.
We're spending a lot of time talking about this.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. That was my impression. That was my impression too, Chris. And actually, we did one out at Longbow, I thought.
That's my impression.
Yeah, I remembered doing one.
Now, we have some policies with some guidelines that we'll probably be coming back to council to revisit.
Okay. So we don't have a prohibition against CFDs and anything.
That's
all right. Let me ask a question regarding, I have two questions. One is, if you went with a mixed-use community on the Levine property, is there anything that you could put in a general plan thing that would say mixed-use community below Williams Field Road, no residential allowed? Is there something like that you can do in the general plan?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, again, the project narrative that comes with it can explain those things. And basically what Mr. Levine is attempting to do here is take pretty much the same plan they got approved before and just give themselves a little bit more flexibility with this. So they're attaching a lot of those same pieces of information. So that's pretty much there in the document already.
And that was my second question, John, because I'm assuming that the reason that they're asking for it is because they want a little more flexibility without residential. They want a little more flexibility below Williams Field Road to maybe move a little bit this way on say, you know, business park versus employment. Would that be the rationale behind it? Andrew's nodding his head. Yes.
Mayor, Vice Mayor.
Susan's there.
Again, Susan Dimmitt with East Gilbert. I just, I just do want to make clear that it was our intention in filing this application to simply gain a little bit more flexibility to manipulate the land uses that were approved in 2006. We've essentially taken the land use plan that you approved in 2006 and included that in our narrative with this general plan amendment request. We've reiterated all the things in there that we agreed to in 2006, which included no residential south of the freeway, no residential south of Williams Field Road, that we intend to keep an employment core in that area south of the freeway, that we're restricting our residential to the areas north of the freeway. We've included all of that in the application with the intention to reassure you that we don't intend to change the overall concept. It's just that the general plan as laid out now, it really ties you down to, you know, say we have 60 acres of commercial in a particular configuration, a particular location. If we want to change that, we have to go through the general plan amendment process. So the mixed-use community district allows us to have some flexibility in that regard.
And you understand, Susan, we're not trying to impugn your integrity. We just don't want to grant rights that we had previously said we don't want there.
No, and we fully understand, and I, you know, if Paul were here this morning, he would reiterate that. But, I mean, we intend to continue to honor the commitment that was made in 2006, and we really tried to emphasize that in the narrative and the application that we submitted this time.
And the reason for the mixed-use community is just what you just said, is that it gives, you know,
you can get
a little acre or two flexibility here, acre or two flexibility there, but the flexibility is not to go to residential. I think you're hearing everybody up here.
No,
well,
we anticipated that before coming this morning, but it's not, you know, not to make significant changes to the land uses, and it also allows us a little easier time to coordinate with DMB as they move their application forward as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor.
Vice Mayor, if I might just add one other point to that. Changing the general plan does not change the underlying zoning. All that zoning that you already approved is still in place, and it is not modified by the general plan. So if they wanted to make any significant changes, they would have to come back through the rezoning process.
It's a very good point that I forgot, Donna. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Wait. Done.
It's not, that's the presentation. And I just want to add two things about density. We talked about it. So we'll talk with the applicant. But for the council, is most of the density figures that we saw is 0.25 and 0.3 FAR, not necessarily too dense. So it's a question to the council and others, is it dense enough? And as far as job, I know DMB said 68,000 here. Just in terms of like regional context, downtown Phoenix is almost 54 jobs per acre. Our downtown, 10 jobs per acre. Their ratio gives me around 18.8 jobs per acre. So I'm not analyzing too much, but those numbers I want to throw everybody so we understand, is it dense enough for us? Is it the jobs are good enough compared to the region? Thank you.
Okay.
Let's move on then to number three, which is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the transaction privilege tax license renewal.
Morning, Mayor and Council. Let me just kick this off quickly before I turn it over to Jenny. I think it's been about a month ago we were here talking to you about the transaction privilege tax license, and our final direction going away was go back and look at our cost recovery on this license and how it's applied. So I know Jenny's worked a great deal with the budget staff to analyze costs. One of the things I'd just like to everybody keep in mind is that these fees were set years ago, typically by benchmark with other cities. We didn't look at our cost recovery at that time. It was not an issue to the council when these were last discussed. I think we last revised ours in 1994, but some of the other cities have not changed theirs in years. Every month, right now we have over 25,000 transaction privilege tax license. Many of those are inactive. But we do process a significant amount of revenue receipts from those folks every month, so that there is significant ongoing cost and significant ongoing activity that's related to that. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jenny, and she can outline the information she's got for you.
Mayor and City Council, one of the items that you asked us to bring back, as Brian mentioned, was full cost recovery for the program. And working with our budget staff, we came up with a figure of, for the first year, the processing and application for this program is approximately $66 per license. After the first year, the ongoing cost is about $53 for the year.
including the technology.
Yes, that includes the proposed cost that we received from our ITD department, our information technology staff, to upgrade the sales tax application and also implement the online submittal. You also asked us for some information for other the other local municipalities. The majority of the local cities have around a $50 application fee, and including an annual fee of $50. You also asked us to find out from the other cities when they last revised the or did any analysis on these fees, and as you can see, the majority of the cities have not done any analysis for 20, 25 years. Chandler is the exception, and they did a cost analysis last year. In addition, I added the number of licenses for each of those communities and the staff that they have working with their tax licenses. While we were talking to the other cities, we discovered that they have a transient license that they provide for those businesses that are in town for an event or just a one-time up to 30-day they're doing their business, such as the Renaissance Fair or something of that nature, at a lower cost. They only receive one sales tax report form, and then the license is closed out automatically. So, when we talked to our information technology staff, they felt that it would take a good 6 months to implement this program if council chose to do so. And so we would suggest that an effective date of October 1st, that would give us enough time to notify our tax license taxpayers and send out the first renewal forms so that they would be returned by the end of September. With that, I can answer any questions you may have.
Okay, Tom?
I guess the first question I have, Jenny, is in your council report, the last paragraph under discussion, or the first paragraph under discussion on the bottom of page one, talks about full cost recovery for the tax program. Is that just processing the license application or the renewal application, or is that covering all, looks like, 72 people who were employed in that department?
Councilmember Rawls, that's for the tax program.
Okay, so that's not just the license.
That's not.
Okay, so we're now thinking of charging taxpayers the full cost of the tax program, so we're basically going to charge them for the privilege of paying us a privilege tax.
This information is just the full cost recovery that the council
of the entire program. But I had no idea that that's what we were talking about. I thought we were talking about the cost of the licensing process, the renewal process or the initial application process, not the entire cost of the program to collect taxes. I mean, that's like asking the American taxpayer to pay over and above their taxes. They now have to pay a fee to cover the IRS. I don't understand that. I'm opposed to it. I think it's absurd, ridiculous, and we shouldn't even be talking about it.
Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Rawls, and I think what Jenny's identifying here is really not only the cost as you identified to submit the application, which I believe if we say it's $66 for the first year in the initial fee and $53 thereon is about $12 for that application process. Every month we're in really responding and processing those receipts that are provided by those 25,000 different licensee holders out there.
Yeah, I understand that, and that's what I think is so totally inappropriate. you're basically telling the taxpayer they have to pay for us. They have to pay us to collect their taxes. And that's the whole idea, is for them to collect, to send in their taxes. You might as well say every time a policeman comes out, we're going to charge you a fee for the policeman, or if you have a fire at your house, you know, too damn bad, you're going to, you know, pay for the cost of the fire department as well. I mean, it's a collecting taxes is a function of government. To force the taxpayer to pay twice is just flat wrong.
Other comments? Scott?
Where's Gilbert on this? Do they not charge that? Or
The town of Gilbert, their taxes are collected by the state of Arizona. They don't have
so
their
that's
own
a completely
department.
Completely different setup then than this one.
But what does that cost Gilbert?
What does that cost Gilbert? That's a good question. I'm going to steal his question. Do we know what that costs Gilbert?
I don't have the total cost for Gilbert.
We don't know what that costs. How much are we collecting on the fees currently?
We have a $50 application fee with no renewal.
I'm sorry.
The revenue.
Receipts, the revenue. How much is that generating in revenue for the... I'm almost...
The
I don't want to use revenue, but how much is that collecting?
Just the license application.
Right.
It's about a little over $275,000 annually.
$275,000? And what is that covering exactly? Because that's a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money for a department.
That's just new license applications.
New license.
So we had over 5,000 new license applications in 2006-2007.
All right. So, and I'm reading this chart that you showed. And so we're doing the $50 fee, initial application, first fees. We don't have an annual renewal right now.
That's correct.
And what's it cost to... I almost don't know if I want to ask this, but what does it cost the city to process these fees and then do the monthly statements and renewals? And
with a renewal program in place, it would be $66, approximately around $13 for the application and $53 for the ongoing process.
So we're back to total, we're looking at cost recovery.
Mm-hmm.
If this goes away, so we if this went away right now, I'm trying to take this from Tom's perspective, we'd be at $275,000, and where would?
Well, it's not just we lose the revenues, but now we've lost track of who's licensed to do business in Mesa, so the ability to go out and do audits and follow up, I'm assuming that would be affected if we didn't have a license.
Are you talking about not having a sales tax license?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, part of the license is knowing who's doing business in Mesa, correct?
That's correct.
And the annual renewal that we don't have today would allow us to kind of clean up this list that we have out there, because we have a tremendous amount of businesses that maybe are coming online that we don't know about, and others that go offline that we don't know that, have that information.
Yes, we find that often when our auditors go out and are doing an audit, or our collectors are out because there hasn't been any sales tax reports filed, is that ownership has changed, maybe even the use of the license has changed. And because we don't have a renewal process, we're not continually sending information out of that nature that would provide us back new ownership or new use of the business.
Any idea last year how much that cost? How many sales tax dollars did we capture last year through that enforcement?
I can tell you, I think we have about $3.5 million just for this fiscal year alone, for the first 7 months, that our audit assessments have brought in.
Significant amount of money. And I guess, Chris, if I'm reading Tom's question right, why not fund this program? Because it seems important that Mesa capture all the sales tax dollars. That's the lifeblood of the city. But why not just direct revenue from the sales tax itself and fund it that way? Why? What's the argument for implementing another fee on top of the sales tax?
I would dare not get into a philosophical debate with Mr. Rawls.
I wouldn't either. Well, I would.
But it is, again, I think it's very typical of cities. Now, I know that's not necessarily a valid argument, but it is something that we use as a way to identify, to register business licenses, transaction privilege licenses, and it has become a revenue source for the city. Without it, we would have to reduce our expenditures within the city by whatever the amount that's being collected. Frankly, we're looking at it as the other side. By creating more registration on an annual basis, a renewal, which I think has been supported by a lot of other, even business community, is knowing who's doing business in Mesa. So, frankly, we can be more effective of making sure that everyone is paying their sales tax that is due. Frankly, we're not quite as efficient and effective without having that information, because our database grows so large, as you know, Jenny was saying, it makes it somewhat difficult for us to really identify who's really in business and who's not. And so that's, you know, I think that's how we look at it, is because we are so dependent on the sales tax component, we feel like, you know, of all the cities, we probably should be the most keen in ability to know who really is doing business in Mesa, and having, and as being proposed here, some technology that would allow us to be even more efficient and be customer service kind of benefit to others, allow them to do some of this online. So, frankly, the perspective from the city manager is, of all the cities, we should be on the leading edge of, you know, sales tax collections and how that's done and implementing that with resources.
One last question on that, with referring only to the annual and renewal fees. None of that will be going to the general fund for revenue. We're not raising money for this, right? This is to support the program, add the technologies, and make it a little easier with that. This goes to your department. It doesn't go to the general fund to be used wherever, right?
Well, she's in the general fund. We don't separate. But what the question was,
cost recovery is not.
Well, but the proposal is, I mean, just to put it straight out there, today we are not collecting the total amount. We're not doing full cost recovery today. So the general funds of the city do then support the operations that were calculated here. We heard the council question, what would it be to get full cost recovery? If the fees were implemented and we get full cost recovery, then that means that there are resources within the general fund that are subsidizing this program today that wouldn't be, and they would be made available for the other larger public safety, library, parks kind of benefits.
I when I was reading this the other day, I tossed this one around to like Tom has. Why are we charging somebody for the privilege of giving us sales tax dollars? But I think it's extremely important that we have an efficient and effective system for making sure that we are collecting the sales tax dollars from everybody. It's not fair for some to pay and others to escape that. It's not fair to the taxpayers or the city itself. These things go to the services that we need. We can have a philosophical debate on a lot of things. Should we be charging this fee? Should we be charging fees for somebody to develop a plan for their own property? Should we can have these debates all day long, but the reality is that this has to be an effective program, should be an easy program, and I think you're moving in that direction with IT. Overall, $66, not a lot of money, especially if you use it well and you get that system up and running properly, and it's extremely important that we collect the sales tax dollars to provide the police and the fire and the other services that this community needs. So I'll support it.
Tom?
Let me see if I can't. There's a difference here. There's a disconnect. I don't have any problem with having a sales tax license issued by the city of Mesa. And I think the city of Mesa ought to recover the cost of issuing that license, which, as I understand, is $12 or $13. Is that right?
That's right.
All right. And then if you want to have a renewal process so that you can keep current on who's in the city, who's not in the city, who's paying, who's not paying. That renewal process costs $10 to $12. Is that what we came up with?
I actually didn't calculate that, but I imagine it's, it would be
okay,
very
I mean,
close
to it's probably
going
to be a little bit less because we have some information. And so, you know, let's say 10. Right? If you've got $25,000 or 25,000 licenses and you collect $10 or $12, let's use 12 because I've already done the calculation, that's $300,000. So you're not going to be losing the $275,000 that we're already collecting. It's just that we're not going to be collecting a premium between 13 and 66 for the initial application and between 12 and 53 for the renewal application that is going to be used to fund the IRS, to fund the tax program. I don't have a problem with the license fee. I don't like the idea of a renewal license, but if you want to have it, I don't have a problem with a renewal license fee, both tagged at full cost recovery. What I think is inappropriate philosophically is to collect more than that in order to cover the cost of actually collecting the taxes. I think collecting taxes is a legitimate function of government that ought to be spread out over the entire community, not just the taxpayers. So that's where I'm trying to draw the distinction, Scott. It's not that I want to say we're not going to have licenses, we're not going to collect our taxes. It's just that full cost recovery to me means for the license process, not for the collection process. You know, it's $66 times $25,000, and I probably should have used 53. So that's about $1.3 million. You know, that's a lot more than it takes to operate this licensing program. So that's what I'm advocating. I'm not advocating zero. I'm advocating license, full cost recovery for licenses, not charging people for the privilege of paying their taxes.
Claudia.
Thank you. I don't think I'm going to get in the philosophical debate here. I look at this, and maybe I am because I'm going in a different direction. I look at this, and if you open a Home Depot or a Lowe's in Scottsdale, Tempe, Chandler, Phoenix, or Glendale, you're going to have to pay the licensing fee initially, and then you're going to have to pay an annual renewal fee. And I'm not sure why the residents of Mesa should be subsidizing the businesses, whereas the residents of the other communities are not subsidizing the businesses. And I'm wondering, you know, if you start thinking about what businesses in Mesa already don't pay. They don't pay a primary property tax. They don't pay a secondary property tax, which is why when you look at expenses per resident versus what the city spends per resident, if you compare Phoenix and Mesa, you see Phoenix spending about $1,000 per resident per year more on city services. Well, where do they get that additional money? They get it from primary and secondary property taxes on businesses, which that isn't happening in the city of Mesa. So looking at the model here, I will tell you that I actually prefer the Tempe model to the one that I'm seeing elsewhere, because Tempe recognizes the fact that there's a difference between a Lowe's, a Home Depot, a small business owner who isn't bringing in very much revenue to the city. And so I like that model that recognizes that there's a difference. The other issue I have, and I think I said this when we started out with the whole thing, Jenny, is that I want from day one, I want people to be able to do the online stuff. And so my feeling is that the implementation of this should be tracked to when we have the ability for people to do this online. If we don't do it that way, I think it presents a hardship that just isn't acceptable. Now, you know, that's just my opinion on the whole thing, but there's where I am. Thank you.
Okay. Kyle, let's see if we can get to four, and we'll give you some direction.
Whether it's from the applicants renewing their license or the public in general, it's still going to be taxpayer dollars paying for the program. So philosophically, I'm not going to have a tremendous amount of heartburn. The program, we need to collect the taxes. We need to have the licenses. That I think everybody agrees we need to have the license. We need the tracking. How it's paid for, we could get in a lot of philosophical discussion, but ultimately the taxpayers, in one way or another, are paying for it. So I think we need to have the renewal But in looking at Tempe's model, the graduated, depending on the impact and how much you're doing, although the cost of processing the application is the same for a small business or a large because it's the same amount of paperwork. It's just they report more money on their form and write a bigger check. But, as far as how much that should be, the renewal fee, I'm not going to have a huge concern one way or the other because ultimately the John Q. Public is the one who's going to pay for it in some form. So I think we need the renewal. We need, initial application renewal. What that amount is, I am not as concerned about as making sure we have the tracking.
Okay. Let me throw in where I'm at on this. I think that there needs to be a fee charged when you take out the license, but I think it needs to be in the $10 to $15, whatever it takes to cost recovery that process. The application fee, I think we do need to implement one because I think it does. I got caught in a situation where I didn't had some licenses that I just had out there for years and never canceled them, and I should have. So to have a renewal fee would help clean up the records, I think, for some businesses. And I think that renewal fee should be nominal, what it costs, again, $10, $15. I have trouble with the $50 and $60 renewal fees because I still think that the people that are collecting this tax go through some effort to keep all the accounting, to write the check, to do the monthly reports on their part, so that we can submit as business owners the taxes to the city. So I am not looking for the city to pay all of their staff when I'm going through all that effort as a businessman in the first place to do it. But I think we do want to keep track of it in an efficient manner, and that cost is legitimate to pass on, but I'm on the low end scale of what I think is appropriate, not the $50 to $60 to help pay for the department. So. That would be my input into the process. Let me go ahead and Councilmember Truitt.
Sometimes I'm wondering if I understood it the last time as well when I see what came back. Mm-hmm. I thought last time when we were sitting here and saying it cost us like $13 to do a new application, and we said, well, we want full cost recovery. In my mind, I want full cost recovery on the application, and I just wasn't convinced the $13 was the full cost recovery. Maybe it needed to be 18 or 20 or something, that it needed to include things like overhead, and it was just raw wages, I thought, that they were putting in there. And I thought full cost recovery to me meant, no, I want it burdened with overhead and, whatever, like a business would do it. And what it would cost us, if all we were doing in that department was applications, what it would cost us to pay all the cost of that. Employee benefits, burden it with Social Security and stuff, just like you'd do in a business. And then you'd come up with what it costs per hour to do that. So I didn't realize we were coming back with, let's fund the whole program on the backs of the applications and the renewal fees. So I guess I'm philosophically where Tom is, but I'm not necessarily convinced that the $13 is the right number. So I'm looking for a number that pays for what it cost us, including all the costs, overhead, et cetera, and then a number for what it cost us to renew it. And so I think we're philosophically in the same place, just what should the number be?
Right. And whether it's $10 or $25, if you're starting a business, it's fairly insignificant. I don't think it's a big deal. So I'm not going to squabble over spending another 6 months to try to figure out what the actual number is. And the same thing with the renewal. I think the renewal is just some nominal fee, $10, $25, whatever it is, so that you can track which licenses are out there and there's a reason for sending the form back. If there was a way to just do it free, check it off, if nothing's changed, that would be okay with me too. But I think there needs to be some process to clean up those numbers of licenses out there to know whether they're active or not, so that it helps the business community, and I think it also helps the city when they're trying to track who's active and how many businesses we have in the city. So that's where I'm at. Tom?
I don't want to spend a lot of time on determining what the exact number is. I mean, I'm comfortable with a $20 application fee and a $10 renewal fee. In fact, I'll you want a motion to that effect, I'll make it. But I don't want to cut the discussion short. But you know, it seems to me right now there's three people who sort of philosophically want to keep it the cost recovery for the licensure. Other people want to capture more of the program cost. So I don't know whether we can get to four today. But I mean, I don't want to have staff spend $200,000 of time to determine whether or not it's $1,850 or $1,872 for the actual cost burdened by the overhead. So I'm comfortable with 15 or 20 and 10. But
okay, let's do a little more discussion, then we'll call on you to try a motion. Vice Mayor.
I think that this is going to have to come back as an ordinance anyway. So whatever we do will then come back as an ordinance, because this is a change in fee schedule. I didn't hear any discussion about implementation of the renewal when, you know, I still have that concern about it being an online, the ability for an online process here, and that's a concern that I have.
Whether the $10 on the renewal is enough money to fund it, is that what you mean?
No, I meant the timeline for doing that, and we didn't have that. Nobody else addressed that. I'm the only person who addressed the timeline on that. I have a concern on the timeline. And it is a good question, Mayor, whether that is enough. I don't know, Tom, if you'd go to 25 for the initial fee, and because I don't think that it is a capture of, you know, my analysis of full cost and all of that stuff. Additionally, I don't think that it captures the maintenance of the system for the renewal thing. So either the initial cost of the computer technology, all of that stuff, I don't think it's capturing that, and I don't think it's capturing the maintenance of the technology. So I don't know what that looks like, but I wonder if you go to 25 and 15, if you'll be able to pick it up.
Okay. Scott.
Well, we're gonna haggle over numbers. We keep throwing out numbers without really any background, it seems. And if we're gonna talk about something, maybe we ought to just talk about the annual renewal fee. We've talked about, what is it, $12 for the license, I believe, is what the number I heard. Why don't we just say, we not talk about the application fee, we'll leave that at the 50. We'll implement an annual renewal fee of $12, which is cost recovery, and we're done for now. That would be my suggestion.
All right, Tom, you want to try your motion? See where we get.
And this is the spirit of compromise and all those other good and wonderful things. I'll make a motion that we have a $25 license application fee and a $12.50 renewal fee.
No. Don't do that.
$12 renewal fee.
Will you go to 15?
I'll go to 15.
Okay.
If you'll second the motion.
I'll second the motion if you go to 15.
25 and 15.
Mayor and Council, can I also understand, is that what the expectation that we're going to have an online system? Because what I think we have to all recognize is we are collecting a certain fee of $50 today. And that is what the city is forecasted into our budget. If this mix of fees, for whatever reason, is changed, we have to go back and forecast and see how much money that's going to generate. If it's less than the current collections today, we don't have the funds to do the online new system unless we then take it from somewhere else.
It depends on how long somebody keeps their license.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because you got $15 per year now on a renewal fee that's coming in.
Right.
So you get up to the $50 in 2 years, you're at 55.
But that's what I'm saying. We need time to look at that, because we're making an assumption here that is equal.
Then I'll back away.
Or more than.
Okay, and I'm willing to wait for that number.
Okay. Right.
Because it seems to me that you only get, well, right now we're only collecting from new applicants. So we're going to collect half from new applicants, but we're going to be collecting renewal. Let's figure out whether that's more or less.
If we can get to a renewal and still get the same amount of dollars to continue, I think we're fine. It's just that we're throwing numbers out, and we haven't had a chance to really go look
at
that.
And come back after March 10th.
Stick with the numbers, because you're going to come back with the resolution for us to adopt, right?
We'll come back in the...
So we can adjust. When you come back, if it doesn't work, tell us what the numbers need to be, and we'll go forward.
Right. My motion today is to instruct staff to develop an ordinance that has a $25 application fee, a $15 renewal fee, subject to a change in the numbers if... Right.
If you tell us that doesn't work.
And that way we can continue the ball rolling. That's a good idea.
The implementation of the computer online stuff and ongoing maintenance of it. So.
Well, I'll back away from the needing to implement them simultaneously because I understand that there may be a cash flow issue there. So yeah. I'll back away from that requirement.
But for the long term.
That wasn't part of the motion anyway, but I recognize what you're saying, Chris, that you need the cash flow in order to be able to do the online system.
Let me ask if the motion maker could modify a little bit to do the issue the transient one-time license also. I think we should address that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's one thing. And have a... So... I guess what,
and that was the $20 number here.
Mm-hmm. I would say 20 would be fine.
And let me ask a question about that, if I could.
Yes.
And I'm glad you brought that up, Mayor. We had a conversation earlier last week, Jenny, about like a group license for people who are at the convention center. How would this apply to that? So could they still get that? Could the group coming in and let's just choose the model shipbuilders of America who come in and they sell a few things and, you know, they have 87 different people and they get one license and they keep track of it. How does this impact that our ability to do that?
Vice Mayor Walters, in that specific instance, there was a small organization that was willing to pay the tax, collect the sales tax information from each of their suppliers.
Participants.
Yes. And we're willing to keep those records for us. What we find is that it really isn't in the organizers. Most organizers do not want to be responsible for the individual stations at those events. The organization that we had a discussion about, they meet regularly. They're a small group of close-knit people. And it worked for them. They were willing to take on that responsibility. It would only be in those instances where the organizer would accept the responsibility to keep the records for the individual
sellers. I'm just trying to make sure that our action here today doesn't preclude that kind of thing that we talked about.
It does not.
Okay, thank you. That's all I needed.
I think one other issue when we talked about sales tax renewals was the business or the owner that owns property, they have a, let's say, a strip center, and there's eight tenants, and they account for each of the eight differently. But they only have one sales tax license for that center. And my understanding is they're supposed to have eight and account for them. Have we resolved that issue on the sales tax?
I'm going to ask Roger Oaken, our tax administrator, to explain that.
I know we've put it on temporary hold, but I don't know if we've ever resolved it.
The code still says that you're supposed to have one license for each property, so we have not changed that.
That's a model tax code that all the cities follow.
Property or business?
For each business location.
Okay.
So on a commercial property, each one would constitute a location, so it would require a separate license.
Okay, I don't know if the council wants to address that at all or not, but it's a... And maybe it's not on the agenda for today, so maybe we should. All right, let's let that one go. I just know it's a looming issue because I know on your tax form you've got eight different spots, so I thought you could just kind of write in all your licenses and send in one form. But you're supposed to do separate license and not do that, right?
Well, the reason they're separate lines is you could have a business that has separate classifications. You could be doing retail and job printing and so on.
Mayor, maybe we can send that to the Audit and Finance Committee to look at a future meeting.
Okay. All right. So, councils, we have a motion and second, or are we just going to do it with direction here?
We have a motion and second. We can do it with direction.
Direction.
All right, with direction?
Yeah.
That's fine?
Mayor, we'd be back to the Audit and Finance Committee. I think we're tentatively scheduled for the 27th of March, and we can bring it back as one of those at that point and have that discussion.
Okay. Why don't we either... Let's make a resolve on whether what we're doing with multiple businesses at a location under one ownership, too. And just so that we've agreed that we're not going to enforce that with Model City Tax Code, or because if we're going to do something, if the fees are low enough, maybe they wouldn't mind getting multiple licenses. because I think that was part of the issue too, that you had to renew them for $66. It's too expensive. So, all right. Number three, hear a presentation. Oops, let's try four. Hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the annexation process.
Councilmembers, Tammy Albright, I'm with Building Safety. This is Laura Heineman, she's with Planning. We're here before you today to talk a little bit about the changes we've made to the annexation process based on the direction we got from Council last April, as well as discuss some of the issues we've had in running those cases for the last 8 months. We also are looking for a little direction on whether or not you want us to move forward with some of the proposals that we have prepared.
Yeah. It's just
all there is a PowerPoint. Basically, last April, Council gave us some direction that said that if a parcel was located in a county island that they could annex and they did not have to be adjacent to our current city limits. They also stated that if somebody wanted our city services, they should annex. And we heard a clear direction that you were looking for some equity and development.
I want to pull the mic around a little bit for you. Then.
Sorry.
Oh, there it is. Right.
So we thought we'd go through some of the things we have already done and are currently doing. We're looking at some new fees, which will be presented to the Audit and Finance Committee following today's meeting. That is an increase in the annexation application fee, a decrease in the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee appeal fee, and a new fee, an annexation equity fee. And we'll go into those details at the Audit and Finance Committee. We also are proposing some changes to the zoning ordinance and the creation of a new annexation guideline. This was presented to the Planning and Zoning Board in draft form for discussion only in January, and will be presented to the P&Z Planning and Zoning Commission or Board in February for a recommendation onto Council. Other changes in the codes that we have done is through the, in December, we presented to the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee changes to the terms and conditions, which would remove the options that are currently in the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee that allow city services to be granted without annexation. And then to speak to the equity issue, staff is recommending that we remove the current code that allows small residential properties to receive city services if they're under 1 acre without any obligation to their off-site improvements. Basically what we're finding is that somebody will buy a larger piece in the county, go divide the property up, and then come back with each individual parcel and look for city services and not be responsible for their off-sites. A couple questions we'd like you to kind of think in your mind as Laura goes over some of the issues is currently we are giving Council pretty much approval recommendations on all of the annexations because if they're not adjacent to the current city limits, we're just kind of giving you a broader summary of what that means to the city and in most cases recommending approval. Is that a good policy? And then in some cases, would the council want to grant utility services without annexation? Because it could cause us some problems with providing other services like police and fire.
In 2006, before this policy was put into place, we received 20 annexation applications. After this policy was implemented, we received 45 annexation applications, and so far in 2008, we have already received 6 annexation applications. Several others have contacted us, so we're on pace with the 45 annexation applications for this year, most likely. The first step in the process is we distribute that application to all affected departments in the city, and I've listed several here, so that they can comment on the case and how it impacts their services. Through that process, they have identified some service challenges that we would like to share with you this morning. I'm going to be giving you an overview of these issues. Representatives from each of those departments are available to you if you have more specific questions about their concerns. In the past, we have always put their comments in our council reports to you, and we will continue to do so, most likely with a little bit more detail. Emergency vehicle access and response time has come up on multiple applications. In this case, the fire department, who drives by every proposed annexation site, was concerned that Sossaman Road had not been built to City of Mesa standards, and the contours of the road could make it impassable during rain or after a rain. And also the shape of this drive leading to this site is long and skinny, and would they actually be able to get there? Those are the kind of concerns they're going to be putting into the staff report with each annexation. They are also evaluating how this affects their response times. Hydrant locations and the flow capacity of these hydrants. Hydrants for these parcels, as they were developed in the county as subdivisions or single lots, are at a different spacing and a different standard than we have in the City of Mesa. So often, parcels that request annexation have a hydrant that may be located further away than is our standard, and the fire department is including that in their comments. They also do not conduct a flow test of each of these hydrants as part of the annexation review. Legal access for utilities and solid waste vehicles is also something that we consider with each annexation. In the case before you, you'll notice that there is a dedicated roadway, 81st, in this area. Right-of-way has been dedicated for a future roadway and utilities. There is a parcel, however, that is between the one that's requesting annexation and this one. Right now, these four, are served by an easement through the county. We'll have to work with the applicant to ensure that a public utilities and facility easement is recorded so that utility lines can be run and that the appropriate access easements are also recorded. This issue came up recently because we have a gated subdivision. Some parcels within it are looking to become annexed to the City of Mesa. You actually saw this case in, I believe, last year. Entire Thunder Mountain came forward, but because they didn't have 100% of the property owners involved, the case was denied. We now are talking to 10 property owners in this general area that are interested in receiving city services, emergency services, and they're requesting annexation. Because this subdivision was developed in the county, the address has a county address. It has individual lot numbers within the subdivision. As part of our process, we most likely would ask them to be assigned a city address. There could be some confusion with the routing of those calls. And we are discussing these issues in great detail because we don't want any errors like that to occur. I've also been informed that the street naming system within this subdivision is inconsistent with the City of Mesa. So there may be street names that exist somewhere else in our city. And when they receive an address in the City of Mesa, it's going to be confusing. And then zoning issues have come up. Some sites are inconsistent with our general plan, our zoning districts, and then also some unusual lot splits have been allowed to occur. This case that you see on the left is actually a mobile home within an existing mobile home subdivision in the county. It has R5 zoning. Comparable zoning in the City of Mesa would be R4. That's very high density. Our general plan indicates in this area medium density, 6 to 10 dwelling units per acre. And also our zoning code allows for mobile home subdivisions in the R16 PAD, which is consistent with our general plan. So we'll be recommending, if this project goes forward, that applicant rezone to R16 PAD, which then makes it kind of spot zoning surrounded by R5. The example on the right is has an R35 in the county, R135 in the city, which is fairly low density, rural, suburban development. Typically, R135 lots in the city of Mesa have 30-foot front yard setbacks, 30-foot rear yard setbacks, and two side yards equivalent to 30-foot setback. Well, as you can see from the shape of this lot, that's going to create a very unusually shaped home, and it's possible that this site is just not able to be built on anyway. With these lot splits occurring in the county, it's difficult for us to ensure that they meet our development requirements. So as I stated, we typically do include comments from all the departments in your council reports. Council looks at each annexation request twice, first during the public hearing that releases the petition, and then a second time when the actual ordinance is adopted. We will be providing you more detailed analysis with that first council report to let you know what some of those concerns are from the various departments. This is most likely going to result in an increased number of recommendations of denial for city council.
So basically what that leads to is that the current policy, if somebody were to receive a denial from city council on their annexation but they still wanted to pursue receiving city services, they would then appeal or go through the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. So they'd have to start a whole nother process with another application. Staff would be doing the same research or using the annexation case, and they would be in front of the TIC, then they would get a recommendation to the council. So what we're asking for some direction on is, would you want to see us modify our policy so that you have an annexation case in front of you, if you denied it, right then and there you would be able to determine if you wanted to still give them city utility services, or if, you know, so we can eliminate that secondary process.
Vice Mayor.
I don't want to see a case where, for instance, somebody has R4 zoning. In order to bring them into the city, we want to have, you know, R6 PAD zoning, and so the council denies the application. The person refuses to change the zoning. We deny the application, and they say, yes, but now I want your city services. I want, you know, utilities. I'm not willing to do this, but it's one thing when it's a hardship that somehow, you know, this person, there's no way for them ever to overcome it. But I don't want to set up an idea in people's mind that they just turn down something that's reasonable for the city to request, and then the expectation would be that, well, okay, now we'll provide you utility services.
Based on the process we're setting up, they would have to agree to all of the conditions that staff has outlined that they would have to do to get in front of you for that annexation case to begin with.
Okay.
So what we're saying is, we don't think from a staff standpoint it's in the best interest of the city to annex them. It's not that they don't want to annex, they're willing to, but in some cases, due to our police and fire response times, you know, it's costing us to go out in the middle of this county island and serve this one little lot, is it a good idea? And would you want to have that option to say, yeah, it might not be a good idea to annex it, but, you know, we're comfortable giving them utility services.
Okay, thank you.
John.
Right now, aren't we just, there's no minimum on annexation size, the 1 acre lot to try and annex?
There's no minimum.
And that presents a challenge in itself for the very reasons you're stating. The economy of, if you're going to have a subdivision and developer brings that in, that's one thing, but one house here, one house there creates a lot more challenges for us.
What we may find is, if we recommend that a hydrant be installed, that a number of neighbors may get together to offset the cost of that. So.
At this point, without putting a minimum on there, staff is just going to bring us recommendations on whether it's feasible or not.
Right.
I actually look forward to some of the discussions. There will be some of them that obviously don't work at this time, but I think if
There was an outline of if you upgrade the streets, the hydrants, the utility service, then bring in this block or whatever. So I think it'll be a dialogue with the area over time, and we'll eventually we'll figure out some areas that will probably never be annexed and others that will finally come together as neighborhoods and groups, and it makes some sense. But I am not interested in spot doing utilities all over the place for somebody else's convenience. If it works out for Mesa, you know, we were going just along a line that had to be contiguous, and then we went to this other. If it works and we can provide services, then, because I think eventually we'll do the 150 square miles or parts, a huge part of it, then work in that direction. But don't make the other taxpayers suffer so that we can service fire and police protection to somebody out that decided at their own risk and knowledge to build in the county island. So keep the best interest of the city of Mesa as a whole as you go through this analysis. And how does that work for the revenues and the services provided to somebody that's outlying? If it doesn't make sense, then put it in the staff report and we'll look at it and probably recommend denial.
Okay. So. Can I just clarify? So I think I understood that you would like to see the analysis of the utility issue in this case as well, so that decision could be made right then and there.
Yeah, I think the fire and police response, the whole utility thing with the trash and other utilities, I think it's appropriate that we look at it.
But I think one of their core questions was, let's say it doesn't make sense for the city and somebody wants to come in, do we give them water service?
No. I would vote no, but we can certainly look at those aspects. But
they have that right to ask for that now.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure they do.
Yeah, there's a process. Mm-hmm. We spent way too many minutes and hours.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But Keno, the question that they're asking is, should they change the process? So we're considering that instead of it's going back to the TIC to go through the process that we're familiar with. Should they change the process so if they recommend denial at that same meeting, the council can then consider whether or not we would be willing to provide utilities even if we denied annexation? So I'm okay with all of that coming to us jointly. I don't have a problem with considering it all as a whole. So that's my answer to that question, but I don't know what anybody else's answer is.
I would agree, but I think I can give a fairly quick response. All right. Any other comments on this one?
My last comment would be, and I know you must have discussed this in the past, you know, what if you were to consider giving them that utility service and they somehow agreed to annexation when others in the areas came forward and they collectively wanted to do that annexation? Do you hold them hostage until they can go out and get enough of their neighbors? Or do you?
Yes.
And they're legal issues.
Mayor and Councilman, quickly, the reason is that we don't have the enforceability of that provision. We can't do a pre-annexation agreement. That's enforceable. According to. I agree.
Without pre-annexation. Okay. Any more direction needed? Okay, so bring them back holistically. We'll try to give a response on both issues. All right. Appointments to boards and committees.
Move for approval.
Motion and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Right. Acknowledging receipt of minutes of boards and committees. Motion and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right. Hear reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Any updates? All right, scheduling of meetings and general information, Mr. Brady.
Mayor Council, we go through the meetings first, and then I'll just quickly give you an update on where we are with sales tax. Reminder again, Audit and Finance Committee meeting will be immediately after this meeting. We also have our next council meeting will be February 19th. That's Tuesday, February 19th, because of the holiday. And we have a joint meeting with the Dobson HOA Board of Directors. You should have received your invitations. That'll be February 20th. It's a Wednesday at 7:30 a.m. at the Landmark Restaurant. And we have a February 1st study session at 7:30 a.m. With a Transportation Infrastructure Committee meeting following that. Just to note, though, Thursday, February 28th, we will be canceling that study session. We have several members, or almost half of the council won't be here that day, so we're going to go ahead and cancel the February 28th. Sorry, disappoint you so much. February 28th study session. And then, Mayor and Council, I've handed out to you, we usually put these in the packet. I wanted to get these to you as quickly as possible. Bring you up to date on the December sales tax. Obviously, it's an important one because of the Christmas sales that we anticipate. Unfortunately, we are continuing to see a degradation in our sales tax numbers. As you can see, just for in the general fund in December, we were under anticipated collections by $1.2 million, almost $1.3 million. We are continuing to see a significant decline in sales tax receipts from what was budgeted, even from what was collected in the prior year. What this means for us on a fiscal basis overall is that we are going to have to continue to modify our shortfall again, and we will be bringing to you a more recent update. We'd like to try to capture the January and February receipts and bring that to you on March 6th, I believe it is. Am I looking at Chuck? Is it? No, 20th. We'll bring it to you in March, our latest forecast update. But it, at least internally, we are now looking at where we talked about a $12.5 million shortfall. We are going to be working with a number probably somewhere between $16 and $15 million internally as we continue to prepare the budget. That means that some of the presentations that we've already queued up for you in March as far as reductions may have to be somewhat revisited depending on where things are. So that's where sales tax is. On the other hand, our utility fund seems to be doing well as far as collections as revenues and expenditures. So we do have some areas that are doing well. Our art centers are doing well, collecting well in their the dollars coming in there. So there are some areas that are doing better than anticipated, but certainly this is a significant one as it impacts us going into next year. And sales tax. One of the things we're also trying to get a better handle on is the positions that we have frozen, that we've done that for some months now, and other expenditures that we are delaying, trying to determine how much of an effect that will have in helping us push out the shortfall out into the future. It doesn't necessarily resolve the shortfall, but it does hopefully extend it further out into the future. We are hoping that the further we can push out the deficit, that at some point the economy may come around. What we don't know today, and this is the part that's, I guess, most concerning, is we don't understand, based on the econometrics, how deep the decline will be and for how long it will exist. Because we're continuing to decline, we haven't necessarily yet seen a reduction or a flattening out. As we've reported in to the councils, I think I briefed you all, we've already made some significant adjustments and reduction in workforce in the building safety department. Nearly one-third of that department positions are being eliminated. We're working on, we've already informed the employees and are going through the city process of that notification and determination of if there's availability of other positions in the city. But we're having to look at all parts of the city where they may be affected by different growth revenues and assessing our need to make adjustments there. And we'll continue to brief the council as we see those numbers come forward. But I just wanted to share this with you because it does have a significant impact on some of the decisions we'll have to be making as we consider the upcoming budget deliberations. Thank you very much.
Tom.
Just to continue the good news for the city, I will be out of town for 3 weeks so that the meetings you can properly excuse me. I'll be back on March 11th.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll do. All right. Are there any requests to speak this morning?
No requests, ma'am.
All right. Then entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned.